Welcome, everybody. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We, of course, going to start our conversation out today talking about the elections yesterday, the primaries that put Hillary Clinton over the top as the first woman to be nominated for president with a major political party in America. Not the first in America, but the first in our history, but the first in a major political party. That leaves a lot of questions open. The questions, of course, are what happens down the general election? What does this mean for Trump versus Hillary Clinton? It also, we have to look at the question of what happens inside the Democratic Party itself and the forces around Bernie Sanders and what that means. He won some primaries yesterday as well. He got less than some people thought he would get in California, but the other races were relatively close between the 50s and 40s and 48 and 52 in some of the other states. So what does that mean for their supporters? We also can look at the question of Paul Ryan and Trump and his blatantly racist statements and Ryan and other Republican leaders kind of dancing around the pinhead of fire, not knowing exactly what to say and hedging their bets. And says a lot about race in American politics. Well, we are joined in studio by Dr. Malaya Cromer, who is director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center and assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Gallaudet College. Good to have you back with us, Malaya.
Thanks for having me.
Eugene Craig III is back in the studio, grassroots activist, third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party. And I keep fading now who he's coming to the Republican Party. He's going to the convention. Oh, we do know that. You're a delegate, right?
No. I lost my delegate bid, but I will still be in Cleveland.
Because you were
I get to have a lot more fun.
You were a Rand Paul man. That's
yes.
Right. And Bhaskar Sankara, who is founding editor of Jacobin and the senior editor and a senior editor at In These Times. And Bhaskar, welcome. Good to have you back.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
410-319-8888 to call in your thoughts and ideas about yesterday's primaries and where this takes this American election. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page, or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But please do join us at 410-319-8888. And Bhaskar, what I was outlining here before we started the conversation and before we got on air, and I was just when I was talking to Malaya Cromer, was that there are a number of levels here. One has to do with how this national election will shape up between Trump and Clinton. But as importantly now, the kind of strange dichotomy and split in the Democratic Party around Sanders' forces and Clinton's forces, how deep they may really be, and how it really is kind of in many ways kind of a really interesting skewed kind of thing. I mean, you've got a lot of young people who have been revved up about the election of Bernie Sanders, and that the majority of black and Latino voters, especially older voters, have gone with Hillary Clinton. Younger black and Latino voters have gone in some part to Sanders. But that also shows that the Democratic Party has become a place where because there is no real left in America, electorally speaking, that African Americans, for the most part, Latinos and women, have found a place, and gay and lesbian activists found a place where they have a voice and some power inside the Democratic Party, which makes them look like the establishment. And then there's the Republicans who have always been the establishment in kind of the white power structure of America, but they are seen as the non-establishment. And how does that play out analytically for you in terms of what's coming up?
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that unlike, let's say, if we were in Europe, I'd be a member of a Labor Party or a Social Democratic Party. As it is, I'm a registered Democrat here. We don't have the same kind of party system that's found elsewhere. You know, we could get in all sorts of academic debates
right.
about why, you know, I think we lost a few key battles in the 1890s and the 1930s. And, you know, so here we are. I'm a registered Democrat. But without a doubt, I do think that there is this this divide and this contradiction kind of between the fact that the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton is going to get the support, I think, of huge segments of capital. And the Democratic Party has always been reliant on a certain type of investor bloc backing the party. So we think of now today as big oil being kind of hand in hand with the Republican Party. We associate big oil with, you know, Cheney and with Bush and with the modern Republican parties. But from the time of FDR up until the early 1980s, big oil was the most important part of the Democratic Party constituency, but so was labor unions and all these other groups.
Right,
so it always had these tensions kind of running within it. And I think there is a real tension today between kind of the aspirations and the feelings and the, not only the aims, but also the method of politics of a lot of the rank and file of the Democratic Party, ordinary Democrats, and a lot of the leadership types like Hillary Clinton and others. So there is that tension, but it, in many ways, and I say this as someone who's a radical and doesn't necessarily, you know, want this to be the case, but in many ways, because of the presence of Trump, and because of the rightful, you know, fear I think people have of a Trump presidency, Democratic constituencies, I think, are going to kind of come together and very much are going to be united against against Trump. I mean, I just think that it might have been a tougher sell if the alternative Hillary Clinton was someone more moderate, like Kasich or Marco Rubio or someone like that. But I think Trump ends up really helping the Democratic leadership and others trying to kind of have a unified party.
How do you see that, Malia?
A little bit differently. I mean,
I'm
think
not surprised.
I think I would argue here that Hillary Rodham Clinton helped herself. She ran a really good campaign. Mm-hmm. She won millions of voters, and she beat Bernie Sanders outright. I think she really demonstrated that she was the candidate that the Democratic Party wanted. And this is with or without Trump, she's the winner. And so that, I mean, that's the way I view this really historic nature of this candidacy. So there was a lot of discussion, I think, throughout this entire campaign that there was some sort of enthusiasm gap with Hillary Clinton. And, you know, after watching the coverage last night, to me, it was really clear that women across this country, there was not an enthusiasm gap whatsoever. People were certainly coalescing behind her, and they were excited about the historic nature of the campaign and excited about what Hillary Clinton will bring to the general election and her ideas. So it's a little, I think, is a slightly different view of the entire race that I think she did present something that made Democrats very excited. And it really does. I think it shows when you start looking at the raw numbers, it shows in the numbers.
Well, I have a slightly different perspective. I actually think there's a model that was already in place of where a similar split between a newer voting bloc and the older establishment voting bloc. If you were to look back at 2012 with Ron Paul's group and the Romney folk, you know, the Romney folk were never able to actually pull the Paul folk into the fold. And because of that, you know, Romney lost by, you know, close margins in Florida and in Virginia and Nevada, states that probably could have, you know, somewhat tipped the election scale. And I see similarities here with the Sanders folk and the Clinton folk. I don't think Hillary Clinton is going to be able to actually pull some of these Bernie Sanders folk in. It gets to a point where if you demonize my candidate to a certain degree, or if I don't see X, Y, Z come from you that I saw in my candidate, on principle, I can't support you. And, you know, a lot of the Bernie Sanders folk that I know are, that's where they are.
So, you know, I think that this is a very critical time here in this election. And clearly Bernie Sanders has made it very clear he's not going to stop the fight. It's the D.C. primary is next week. He's going to go through the D.C. primary and they're going to take it all the way to the convention. And the question is what that means. The splits are happening in both parties here, yep. And they're profound, I think, in many ways. I'm going to talk about the Republicans in a minute and with the Rand Paul statement. And Malia and I were talking about before we went on the air, a slightly different perspective on them. I think we should put them on the table, which I think is really important to discuss. But we're watching this thing going on with Sanders now, and there's a lot of people in the Sanders camp, especially the newest voters inside that camp. 675,000 new voters registered in California, 75% of them being Democrats, most of them going for Bernie, even though Bernie lost to Hillary. In that race, and there can be all kinds of complexities why, but he lost that race. But the question is, there's a difference between like a movement, Black Lives Matter and Occupy, and young people gathering around a particular candidate, yep. And pushing for those candidates. But there is some crossplay here, and a lot of people brought into this Democratic primary, Bhaskar may not end up, I mean, it's going to be a fight on the Hillary side to be able to pull those people in to vote for her in this race against Trump. You've heard there's one poll I've seen, different polls, from 15 to 20% of Bernie Sanders voters said they would vote for Trump, which is a huge number. So how do we look at that? Go ahead, Malia, and then go to Bhaskar.
So my question is, why does it have to be a fight? So if Bernie Sanders is going to run as a Democrat in the Democratic Party, why isn't he immediately then, I think, trying to get those young people he has brought into the party to coalesce around Clinton? So we're talking about a Democratic primary here, and I think that's really important. This is the party that matters for these voters. He should be at this stage of the game. If he can recognize that there is that fracturing happening, as somebody who's running as a Democratic candidate who has lost, he should have those individuals, I think, try to get those individuals to coalesce. So the question is, like, why isn't he?
I think it's a matter of Bernie realizing that we have a two-party system. And the only way that you get some kind of traction in this country is if you play within one of the parties. And the only way he was able to get some traction was to play within one of the parties. And he, you know, had to play within the party. I don't think he's a party guy by nature. I mean, he's, you know, been a registered independent his entire time he's been in Congress. He's caucused with the Democrats, but he's on paper a registered independent.
Right.
And so I don't think it's reasonable to expect him to, you know, after he loses, to come in and say, okay, well, you know, let me go kiss the ring of the party elders, you know, and try to get my folk to come in. I mean, he said very clearly, Hillary has to provide a case for my people to vote for her, not me.
Bhaskar?
This is very similar to language Hillary Clinton used in 2008, though. And again, I say someone who wouldn't mind if Sanders took a more confrontational stance. But the thing is, he was campaigning up until yesterday. He's campaigning in the largest state in the country. So obviously he's not at that point going to try to bring people into Hillary Clinton's tent. He's actively trying to campaign against her. I think that after the convention, you will see Sanders making an effort. But also beyond that, I think there's nothing to say that there's a substantial segment of the Sanders voting bloc, especially in swing states, that are going to vote for Donald Trump. I think there's some of that polling has to do with states where there was open primaries and independents. I think Sanders is a stronger candidate among independents and other people who aren't Democrats that might constitute a lot of that 10-15%. I think when it comes down to it, this won't be a very close election, and at least in the Electoral College. I do think that the vast majority of Sanders voters are going to support Hillary Clinton. And beyond that, even though it might seem that there's a lot of hostility in the Democratic Party between, Clinton supporters and Sanders supporters, I think a lot of that is just hostility among different media, commentators and other people. Because if you actually look at the favorability rate of the two candidates, there's Hillary Clinton remains a favorable figure among a lot of Sanders voters, and Sanders is also still viewed favorably among a lot of Clinton supporters. And this is at the end of a at times bitter campaign. So I think a lot of this rhetoric about, you know, where Sanders voters are going and things like that are a bit overstated. I do think that there would be a potential issue of turning out young Sanders voters, and disproportionately young people voted for Sanders. And these are people the Democratic Party sometimes has trouble turning out. I think Donald Trump serves as the get-out-the-vote mechanism that the party really wanted. And I think a lot of these people are going to come up just because of fear of Trump.
Now, and talking about that, let's talk a bit about Trump. Folks, do join us here with your thoughts at 410-319-8888. We run a show here with viewpoints from right to left and in the middle everywhere else to kind of have a good conversation going. I make no bones about my dismay at where America is going with somebody like Trump at the head of the Republican Party ticket, and what that says about who we are as a people and where our country is going. And so, to be clear about that when I say that, because I just want to be very clear with all the listeners and everybody else here. But you know, when you see Paul Ryan yesterday, I think it was yesterday. A day before, whenever that was, when he made the comment about responding to Trump's comment about the judge saying he could not try his case because he was a Mexican and you know, I want to build the wall, so this guy would be prejudiced, and plus there shouldn't be Muslims on our jury because they won't like me either. And then Paul Ryan says, well, that was a classic racist statement,
yeah.
And then goes on to say, but I'm still supporting Trump. So you can look at that in a couple of ways. But to me, you need to throw this out here, and Malaya jump in, and then let's go jump into all of us jump into it. Is that that shows to me how little people like Paul Ryan and many Republicans, and I would add some Democrats as well, but many Republicans in this case care about race or think about the importance of race. Well, oh, he's racist. That's fine, but we're going to love him and take him. We're going to fight for him anyway because we want him to be president of the United States because we're Republicans.
Rather, so the issue is this, all right? Paul Ryan, from day one, has been the voice of moderation in this entire...
That says something in itself.
Well, I'll say this. I think Paul's an amazing person. I think he's been an amazing speaker. He's had a backbone. He's been somebody that's leading on issues like poverty and putting a real agenda forward. The Republican Party doesn't have a sitting president that could come in and rein everybody in and pull everybody together. The closest thing we have to that is a Paul Ryan. And quite frankly, you know, I'm never Trump, never Hillary. I think, you know, Trump's racist statements totally disqualify him in my eyes. And the only thing that will, you know, maybe, you know, get me to even consider voting for him in the fall would be in a full unequivocal apology for a couple things that he said. You know, put some respect on our name. You know, I can't, I'm not tolerating it. But with that being said, when it comes to the dichotomy of either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, you know, from the that perspective, a Republican Speaker of the House can get a lot more accomplished with the Republican president than he ever will with the Hillary Clinton. And from that perspective, I can understand, you know, Paul Rice's support in name only.
So I'm sort of on, in a way, on the same kind of wavelength you are. I really think that Paul Ryan is an individual who thinks he can fill in the policy gaps with Donald Trump. And so if you think about the Trump platform, if you will, there's a lot of there's a lot of vague statements and big ideas.
It's going to be great. It's going to be fabulous.
It's going to be great and fabulous and not a lot of details. And so I think that when we think about Paul Ryan, When I heard him say that statement, I thought he is really going after this idea that Ted Cruz had brought up about the that Trump is malleable. And he had used that as an attack ad. Jimmy Carter had said that in a speech. And I really think that Paul Ryan and the rest of some of the Republican establishment view him as perhaps malleable. They can fill in the blanks of a policy agenda that is yet to come to full fruition. So that's when I heard that statement, that's exactly my takeaway from it.
And Bhaskar, please jump in here. One of the things I was reading I really was taken with was John Nichols' analysis in The Nation of this thing about – I don't know if you saw it that he wrote about Paul Ryan. Textbook racism is not a deal breaker for Paul Ryan. I mean, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Paul Ryan and a lot of the Republican establishment think that Trump is going to lose in November. And they're more concerned about long-term how they're going to maintain their congressional majority. And how they're not going to get primaried from the right by kind of angry Trump supporters and other people. So I think that this is all basically, you know, all about preserving the party and their congressional majority for the long term. And they hope that they'll, after the experience of Trump and his massive defeat in November, they'll be able to put in a more palatable, more establishment candidate in 2020 and win that election. I really think it's that and nothing deeper.
Well, yeah.
So and he's absolutely right. So we talked about the down ballot effect. So last night, in the midst of all this, there was an interesting, the first kind of really hard down ballot loss for a Trump supporter. So Renee Elmers is a Tea Party North Carolina Republican who lost in her primary election. And she was the first congresswoman to come out in support of Donald Trump. So this is, the secondary narrative that's really important. It's not just Trump in the agenda, but Trump in the down ballot. And it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. A lot of the states now will have their congressional primaries after their presidential primaries to see what this actually starts to look like, and especially in November.
So, you know, one thing that I've been looking at throughout our primary process is the effect down ballot. One thing that I've been seeing is that voters that are new to the primary system, they typically vote in general. They aren't new voters. They aren't newly registered voters. They just come out in primary instead of just turn out in general. They're voting for president, and they aren't going down ballot. So this isn't like a 2010 wave. The issue with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan is that with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, every House seat – That has a quick PVI of R5 and below.
What does that mean?
Partisan rating. You know, their district is, you know, somewhat of a toss-up.
It's a swing.
Swing district.
Right.
It's now at risk. You know, your Will Hurts, your Mia Loves, you know, are at risk. You know, and our majority of the Senate is at risk. I mean, one thing, you know, I'm by no stretch a Mitch McConnell guy, but one thing I have said publicly is that I do respect him for understanding minority voting in this country. I mean, for him, you know, yesterday came out and said straightforward. He said, you know, Donald Trump, the path that he's going on, you know, he's going to alienate Latinos the same way, you know, Barry Goldwater alienated blacks in 1964. He's absolutely correct. And that's what their concern is, you know, looking at this whole, you know, debacle. But because of their position, you know, they have to support the nominee at least in name only. You know, rather, you know, they probably would never get a dime, won't do anything, you know, action-wise. But because of position, you know, within the party, you know, you have to support the nominee in name only.
I'm going to get to the phones here. And I think it says a lot when Donald Trump is too racist for certain people that I would consider having a lot of racist thoughts in their head. So 410-3 Emily, I made a face. 410-319 You can respond. It's okay. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Donna, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
Very well. Good morning.
And enjoying your guest.
Thank you.
My biggest concern with Donald Trump and how our America is being split in half is that we know that men, males in our society who are sexist are going to gravitate towards him. We also know that he's going to gravitate to people with the Hispanic, Latino, the racial component. I have a concern that he's going to pick up votes from all racial ethnic groups.
Who, Trump?
Trump. Even in the African American community, among black males who also have issues about where women's place are in society. So that's one of my concerns. Another concern I have is that if Hillary Clinton does not get that millennial and Generation X population, if we don't get their vote, she will lose. And she really has to work with Bernie Sanders in getting that vote. My final point is, I think America, society is going to have to understand that whoever becomes the next president will decide not only our Supreme Court justices, but all our federal justices, all the different circuits, as well as our district courts. And if, because, you know, with Title VII and employment discrimination on the rise, rampant throughout this country, there's not going to be, your rights as citizens are going to be eroded if these judges, if we have our district court and our circuit court judges and our Supreme Court judges are extremely conservative, we're going to lose this country. And I wanted your guests to talk about that, and I'll hang up and listen. And thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll start from the point that you raised, earlier, Malaya, which I think is really an important point that actually we discussed a lot, even in my home, with Valerie and other people around, thinking that as racism runs deep in America, misogyny runs really deep across the spectrum in this country and across the world, and that is an issue in terms of Hillary's campaign, that it may be really hard for women to win a race merely because the candidate's a woman, and then there are many backward men in the United States of America, and women as well.
So what I think was really interesting, and I'm glad that she brought up these points, the caller brought up the points. So my favorite part of the Hillary speech last night is when – and my favorite attack that she has leveled against Donald Trump is the temperament argument. He's too – the reason I like it so much is because one of the key things against women in politics through years and years and years was the idea that women were emotionally unstable or too emotional to be the commander-in-chief. So I think that part of me really likes the idea that she has turned this on her head and she's really kind of leveled this attack at Trump, that he does not have the appropriate temperament. And also another, you know, consistent theme throughout American history is that women were unable to handle foreign policy issues. And so this is a gender-based stereotype that has really been dissipated. When we start with, think about Margaret Thatcher and Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, have really pushed back against this narrative. And now I think that people no longer deeply hold that stereotype. So this is something interesting, I think, that the Clinton campaign or her candidacy has done for women in politics, and the role model effect notwithstanding. So she's done a lot, I think, in her campaign and in 2008 to really kind of mitigate some of these gender perceptions towards women in public office.
So we have to give you a short break. We'll come right to here with Boxcar's thought of that, as well as Eugene's and yours at 410-319-8888. Stay with us as we continue our look at the presidential race, the primaries yesterday, and what's to come, and who might be the vice presidential candidates, and what that might mean for either party. Welcome back. We are here with Dr. Malaya Cromer, director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center, who is also assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Goucher College, Eugene Craig III, grassroots activist, third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party, Boxcar Sankara, who is founding editor of Jacobin and a senior editor at In These Times, and you at 410-319-8888. And please tweet us at Mark Steiner or send an email to talk@steinershow.org. Boxcar, jump into that. Just the role that the what one thing Donna was saying was the importance for her was of a Democrat winning, giving the Supreme Court and all the issues that are facing America. On the other hand, the depth of misogyny in America and how much that may or may not affect this campaign and what that means. How do you analyze that?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, you know, I'm someone who thought that on the issues most pertinent to working-class people. And the working class today, you know, contrary to, I think, a lot of the way that it's used kind of glibly, the term, is disproportionately women. There's more women in the job market now than men. I thought Sanders was stronger on those issues, but there's no doubt that there is some real tangible gains from having women like Hillary Clinton in prominent positions and having those barriers be broken. And I think you saw that in her speech yesterday, where she was able to point to the fight for women's equality throughout the 20th century and place herself in that tradition. And I don't, and I might disagree with some Sanders supporters, but I don't think that's all just for show or that's all politics. I think there is some real truth for that. But I guess, like, my only concern with just leaving it there and not going deeper or not pushing for more change than the Hillary Clintons of the world would want for is that, you know, obviously we want women to be equal to men, but, you know, like the saying goes, men are not equal with themselves. We still have tremendous class divisions in this country, and we still have gross inequity even among men, and that cuts across, you know, class lines and things like that. So obviously, you know, I think that for one, you know, a Democrat in the White House would be a better thing than having a Republican in the White House for those committed to social justice. But given Clinton's base of support, given the track record of, you know, recent Democratic Party administrations, I don't have much hope that we'll actually get the sweeping, substantive change we actually need in the country as far as income inequality and a lot of these other issues. So right now we're again in a situation where, you know, the better choice is a Democrat, but it's kind of a defensive posture. I think what was actually inspiring for a lot of people about the Sanders campaign was the promise of actually, you know, pushing for more radical and more substantive change and actually putting these issues on the agenda. And to the extent that Clinton's agenda is more populist than it was in 2008, I think a lot has to, you know, be thanked on to Sanders and what he's injected into this race.
Now, I think that one of the things that Bernie Sanders clearly has done is push the Democratic Party to address issues of social justice that they've never really done in this kind of in depth like this before. Always, you always had to, from the 60s on, you often had to pull Democrats kicking and screaming into that fold. And I think that's something that Bernie has clearly done. But I think there is, you know, this interesting. Let's just for a minute. Let me digress on something with the three of you, because you raised something here, Boxcar, and we've talked about around this, that the juncture of class and race in America has always been a very volatile one, and a confusing one, given the nature of this country, and the role that racism plays in this country, and also the class divide. But the class divide also plays, and I'll go back to Boxcar very quickly, and then we'll come back to the other two folks in the room here. It's playing out across the board here because, you know, it was one interesting poll I read about the last election with Obama, where the majority of white working class men voted Republican, but the majority of white working class men who were in unions voted for Obama. So there is a lot of what fuels some of the white working class angst in America, besides the economic conditions, has to do with the changing nature of America, quote unquote, and it's no longer this white place, and what we had we're losing. So I mean, when we talk about the class issues, Boxcar, it's not a simple divide here. And how you even begin to bridge that divide is some divide something that people on the left have always been wrestling with and have never been able to get to. And I think you even see it in some ways inside of Bernie's camp.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's key is that you actually need to put forward a platform and actually say that you're speaking to people's grievances, and also put forward platforms that basically say to people that, you know, your choice isn't between hanging on to vestiges of white privilege and things like that, or, you know, going forward into this kind of new scary economy or whatnot. The real choices between people are, you know, fighting behind an agenda that will, give more social welfare, give job guarantees, give things like that to people who need them. And, you know, I think if given the choice, the vast majority of workers, including white workers, would choose, what seemed to be a realistic, viable, social democratic kind of agenda behind expanding public goods and whatnot, over just voting kind of behind petty kind of racial things. And I think so. In other words, that, you know, if you give people the option, you'll see less racism. I mean, for the longest time, white workers continued to vote Democrat despite even the loss of the solid South. So I think some of our history of the 1960s and 1970s of when the shift actually happened is wrong. So we think of it often like a backlash to the gains of the civil rights movement. But, you know, white workers in the South even kept voting Democrat up until Carter's second term. So I really don't think that it's quite that simple. I think Sanders showed the Democratic Party, or at least those paying attention, that, white workers shouldn't be written off, that they could be won over. And, you know, I think that's a major advance, because, you know, the real base of Donald Trump isn't in just the white working class. It's primarily in white professionals and people like that. You know, if you look at his average income of his supporters, like $70,000, $75,000, it's not quite what the media has been depicting, which is this kind of organic kind of base of support rooted primarily in white workers.
Gene and Malia.
I think it's an interesting dichotomy. I think it's an interesting mix and mold. I do think, you know, Sanders has, brought the working class issues back to the forefront of the Democrat Party. I do think for a while, Democrat Party, at the top, kind of like the Republican Party. It was a big money interest party. And I do think the candidacy of Bernie Sanders has brought that back to the forefront. But do I think the, underlying issues of racism and sexism, do I think that they'll be players as they have in the past in this election? Personally, no. I'll say this. Among myself and a couple other Republicans of color were discussing last night, November, and looking at, Hillary's operation, and I wanted to say this earlier, but we, guys were going on, I don't think, Trump's as big as a threat as people see, may see or perceive. Hillary's operation really scares me. The messaging coming out of her campaign really scares me as a Republican. And I'm going to tell you why. It's positive. It's resonating. And I think, if the trajectory that we're currently on with the two of them plays out, the way it is, you may see a Clinton presidency with, some Sanders leanings.
And then I want to get a couple quick calls in here before we have to go to our next segment.
Sure. I think what's frankly really interesting is this idea that Bernie Sanders is somehow now the standard bearer of all these Democratic priorities that, frankly, Barack Obama had during his election and he's really pushed during his 8 years as president. So it's not like Bernie Sanders is the first person to ever bring up some of these social justice issues, addressing the wage gap and affordable college and other social justice issues. Just Hillary Clinton has a different perspective. And frankly, she has a perspective that an overwhelming majority of Democratic voters endorse during this primary election season. You know, it's more realistic, it's more incremental, and it's not these big, broad, sweeping, no-compromise sort of policy issues. It's just, for example, with free college. She's talking about affordable college. She's talking about reducing college debt, not giving everybody a free college education, because she understands, frankly, that with a Republican majority in Congress, that these types of things, it's not happening. Absolutely not happening. And so I think a lot of times we forget that Americans do like compromise, and they do like policy change, perhaps incremental change, not these broad sweeping changes. And I think that she did offer that, still within line of the Democratic policy perspective that is not unique to Bernie Sanders, that was pushed for through the 8 years of Obama.
We only have a couple minutes left, so let me get a couple quick calls in here, some really quick closing thoughts so we get to Councilman Holton on another issue. 410-319-8888. Sammy, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, how's it going? I was wondering, why is there so much focus on Hillary Clinton being a woman, in particular, is this her going to the White House being a landmark for women's history? I mean, I think the policies, her neoliberal and imperialist policies, have done quite a bit of damage to women all over the world, in particular women of color. And just like with the Obama presidency and the negligible impact that has had on black people in this country, I don't really see how Hillary being president could really push, make things better for women in this country.
Look, thanks for the thought, Sammy. I mean, that's one of the issues I think will arise, especially among the Sanders supporters coming up, and build around her foreign policy and those kind of policies. 410-319-8888. Ellen, you're on the air. Quick thought.
I feel like I'm between a rock and a hard place. I didn't vote for Obama because I couldn't have blood on my hands anymore. I mean, I voted always the lesser of two evils my whole life, and I get evil. And here's a dilemma. You know, I think it's for all the people who, and not that Sanders had such, you know, a clear foreign policy agenda either. If we get Trump, I feel like, you know, we deserve Trump, whatever he is. And anyway, that's sort of.
We don't deserve Trump.
And that came from a Republican. Ellen, thank you.
If we elect him, we deserve him. And, who is it who said, you know, Du Bois, you know, that you can't trust people with their ballots. You certainly can't trust them with bullets. So, you know, if we can't trust the American people with ballots, we deserve what we get. And foreign policy, I just can't have blood on my hands anymore. That's it.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thanks.
Closing thoughts really quickly, and when you do your quick closing thoughts here, what about the vice president's candidates for either one of these candidates, Buxar?
Yeah, well, I think what's clear is that, you know, I think voting a lot of times is a tactical decision. You know, I'm in New York, so I'm going to vote for Joe Stein. If I was in Virginia, to be perfectly honest, I would vote for Hillary Clinton, I'm sure. So I think a lot of times, you know, I agree that I wish it was more of a moral decision for everyone, but I think of it as a, you know, as a tactical decision. Trump presidency is something that we don't deserve. And if you look at the polling, I think we should hope that this trend continues. But it looks like the American people are actually going to not be supporting Trump. And beyond that, I really think the Sanders campaign shows that there is this burgeoning left of center coalition that has the potential. It's very young. It has the potential to shape the next 10, 15 years of American politics. So I think when it's said and done, at least maybe this is wishful thinking, I hope that it's the Sanders coalition, not the Trump coalition, that actually makes a dent in American politics over the next decade.
We have like 30 seconds. I'm terribly sorry.
Marsha Blackburn, Bob Corker, looking at VP for Trump.
Interesting.
That was short and sweet. I think it's important that Hillary Clinton is a woman because it's historic, and nobody can take that away from her. And I think it's important for Republican women as well. So little Republican girls, just like little Democratic girls across the country, got to see a historic moment last night. It's important for them, whether they grow up with Democratic principles or whether they grow up with free market principles.
Vice President?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Julian Castro.
That's what I've been thinking as well for a long, long time, for a couple of years now. Thank you all three so much. Dr. Malia Cromer from Goucher College and Eugene Craig, Republican Party activist, Baxter Sankara, founding editor of Jacobin. Thank the three of you so much for being with us. We're going to take a very short break and come right back. And it's time for Councilwoman Helen Holton and what's happening on the city council. Don't go away.